thanks for the invite. Thanks all for coming. And apologies, I always, when I look at my own titles, I think at some point I'm going to say this is a joke, but it's not a joke. I am going to talk about mutant mice, and I'm going to talk about mapping them in some rather kind of complex ways, I hope. There is a context for this. One of them is the fact that I'm on a three-year ESRC fellowship, which is looking at what I've called the biogeography of genetically altered animals. This is tracing, mapping perhaps, the development, the circulation, and the regulation of a range of mutant mice models. And so my method is a series of explorations and interventions into key sites where these animals are being produced, negotiated, and contested. This project has got several aims. In the context of what I'm calling post-genomics, and I'll explain a little bit about that later, a key aim is to consider the bio in the geographies of biotechnology, following people's research practices as they seek to add the complexities of biology onto the code traced through the Human Genome Project. It also aims to say more about the topologies or the spatialities of knowledge practices, exploring the nature of experimental and other sites through which the achievements of post-genomics are being remade. These networks of post-genomic biology traverse disciplinary and international boundaries. There are emerging debates then about whose ethics, whose expertise, and whose understanding of these animals are to be the basis of circulation. And I focus here primarily on the changing configuration of materials, animals, and expertise in the animal house, but within a context where the animal model is increasingly expected to talk to articulate with clinical practices. So questions about the relation between standardization or harmonization, between local expertise and ethics, are being explored in all sorts of connective spaces of science, online and in conference. And what I want to do today is just introduce one arena of conceptual work for this project, which is around the concept of the monstrous. And this is really an example of your own words coming back to haunt you. I wrote about the potential for a geography of monsters in an editorial a while ago, which explored art and genetics for the journal Geoforum. And so when Deborah Dixon got in contact with me and said, I'm running a session on the monstrous in geography at the AAG, I kind of couldn't really say no. Steve also couldn't really say no, so he was in the same session as well. But I have to say, I have to make my confession here, I felt at the time it might be a distraction. I was involved with trying to trace all of these serious research scientists, and I imagined that the monstrous was going to be at the boundaries of this science, something I'd have to pursue through something a little bit side to this project, through artistic practices, through some of the sort of bio art that's going on very much at the borders of science, where you might find languages of the monstrous much more obviously used. However, as I began to kind of work through this in a little bit more detail, alongside this ongoing fieldwork with the mutant mouse models, I came to a slightly different conclusion, and this is going to be the bulk of the argument that I make through the paper. The paper is an account of these engagements and the emerging conceptualizations around the monstrous. I've organized it through a series of ethnographic moments, so there's going to be talk about where I was and who I was with and what I was doing. From these, I want to try and develop arguments that post-genomics are placing a monstrous biology at their core. The monsters are moving in from the margins. The scale and ambition of the attempt to add biology back onto the diagrammatical abstractions of the genome map is in some senses monstrous in itself. But more than this, it causes disruptions and breaches which challenge the reductionist accounts of genetics within biology. And this paper is now being developed for a special issue for GeoForum, so I very much welcome your thoughts. And I want to start with the mice themselves. These are liminal creatures. They're at the borders of worlds with sometimes monstrous potential. Mice and rats have this complex biological and cultural exchange with humans throughout the agricultural history. There's a traditional biogeography of the house mouse. It places its wild ancestors in southern Asia. The mouse spreads to the Mediterranean basin around 8,000 BC and the rest of Europe around 1,000 BC. It travels to all parts of the globe occupied by humans, following trade routes and enjoying population explosions, where there are developed forms development of settled forms of farming based on grain, which you can see here. These mice are incredibly adaptable. They can live in all environments from the tropics to the Arctic. They're also very behaviourally adaptable. They live socially in anything from small family groups to enormous swarms of literally thousands of animals, which tended to emerge around the corn ricks, which were out in the fields in Victorian and earlier periods. And if you've never seen a mouse swarm, put the term into YouTube. The video that comes up first actually has a warning on the front that you may find the images offensive. So I watched the whole thing. And it's mice. There's nothing particularly else going on in this, but mice. Literally thousands and thousands of mice. More than you would ever want to imagine. Their monstrosity emerges from their apparently limitless potential for reproduction and consumption, from their excess. Mice mature early and breed rapidly. Their teeth continually grow, allowing them to eat and access a range of food. They can be extraordinarily destructive of crops and the structures built to protect them. And it's this apparently excessive appetite for food and for sex, which means they've been seen as both a threat to human food security and also human moral values. The writer Jonathan Burt has argued that the mouse and the rat imitate the human's own prodigious appetite. They're like an anti-system, the embodiment of a drive to consume and nothing more. And there have been many historic attempts to incorporate these mice into the auspices of human authority and agency. I'm going to take a diversion back to early medieval Europe here, and there's a fantastic, really rather bewitching book called The Criminal Prosecution and Capital Punishment of Animals. It was compiled by Evans in the late 19th century, and it reflects back on the place of animals in the courts of early modern Europe. I want to cite it here because I think it's one of these wonderful sensitising devices. So the context is medieval Europe, where a variety of insects and mice have been attacking vineyards in south of France. Under the authority of the medieval court system, a prosecutor and an advocate are appointed for these animals, and a visit to the vines arranged to survey the damage. The ecclesiastical court meets, but the sitting is adjourned as arguments circle around the place of these animals within natural law and in relation to more human culpability. The book explores these complexities for several pages, yet the final outcome of the case remains obscure. After repeated sittings, Evans reports, "The final decision of the case, after such careful deliberation and so long delay, is rendered doubtful by the unfortunate circumstance that the large page of the records has been destroyed by rats, mice, or bugs of some sort. The animal's excess destroys the language and law used to try and tame them." So in other contexts, and sort of skipping forward to molecular biology now, the biological exuberance of these animals has been more thoroughly, though not totally, domesticated. And I want to move here to the development of the laboratory mouse. If you're interested in this story, the historian of science, Karen Rader, provides a compelling history of the process of making standardized laboratory mice from the late 19th century to the early 1950s. The story actually starts with their diversity. The waves of human and mouse migration means there's been species differentiation and divergence. In Europe, there are two main subspecies, the West European and the East European house mouse. And at points where these subspecies interbreed, there's a natural genetic diversity, a proliferation of visible traits of coat colour, of texture, and also of behaviour. And these were periodically picked up, inbred, traded, to produce identifiable breeds of fancy mice, which had different coat colours. From these Victorian fancy rat and mouse societies, early experiments in breeding and developing inbred strains developed. And these have been critical to 20th century research in cancer, toxicology testing, and mammalian genetics. The very characteristics which made these animal pests, resilience in the face of inbreeding and fast reproduction, made them easy to produce in large numbers in the laboratory. So there are now swarms of inbred mice strains within laboratories across the world. Yet, in many ways, they remain liminal figures, certainly to developments in biology since the 1950s. They figure as only bit parts in the main drama of post-war biological discovery and also in social scientific accounts. And I've enjoyed collecting these somewhat shadowy figures in my reading. So authors rarely pause to consider the development of mouse embryonic stem cells. They move quickly on from experiments in mouse IVF to something larger and more interesting, usually people. In pharmaceutical development, the focus is on human and clinical trials, not the animal contribution to preclinical testing. In genetics, the animal body is deliberately erased, as is going on the right here, decentered through the aims of molecular biology and dematerialized into a string of genetic code. Yet the mouse is now moving to the center of contemporary biology. In the process, it reveals their partial domestication to the grammars of biology in which they are inserted. Derrida's notion of the arrivant refers to that which arrives, usually from the margins, decentering existing truths. The arrivant is akin to monstrosity, functioning as an excess, disturbing the assumptions of logocentrism, of what we see as given in language. I want to follow the complex topologies that flow from this monstrous arrivant from the mouse as it enters the different sites and practices of postgenomics. And as I want to conclude, these monstrous mice may again be eating the words we use to try and tame them. So this is an aerial view of a gene sequencing centre in the UK. It played a key role in the sequencing of the human genome from 1990 to 2003. And there's a version of this aerial photograph reproduced in the entrance hall alongside an artistic representation of the array of letters which are the outcome of this mapping project. I set up a visit to this centre to explore what they're doing now. Once I've met with my contact and gone through these introductory protocols of both cordiality and security, he takes me on a tour of the facilities. As we set off, he pauses in front of this view. This, he says, reflects the change in emphasis in our work. He points to the buildings on the north of the site. Just to give you a little bit of a reference point, this is north, and these are the buildings that I'm talking about first. They're grey, box-like, and arranged at a series of angles. They juxtapose awkwardly with the landscape. He makes the analogy. They look like a series of nondescript grey office computers, ones that you might have found in the late 1990s. And he says they do contain a lot of computers. The buildings were the main site for the sequencing work done here to map the human genome. This was an internationally collaborative, at times competitive effort, with individual researchers working on different chromosomes or genes. The majority of this work was achieved through biological samples and large sequencing computers. It's biology as code, genomics as technics. Its relation to the rest of biology and to the landscape around it, for the time being, is irrelevant. He tells me that each building is organised into linear corridors, each focusing on a separate gene. These elements could then be easily added together. All had shared understandings of the project, reducing the complexity of biology to a four-letter code. The outcome of this is a long list of letters, A, T, C, and G, placing the 3 billion base pairs that make up human DNA. The project was completed early and with considerable publicity, which painted it as the ultimate portrait of humanity. Yet, of course, on its own, it tells us very little. Without establishing relations between species, between genes, proteins, pathways, and bodies, it's a map without a referent, the ultimate reduction of human biology to mere DNA. And as Sarah Franklin, Fox Keller, and others have pointed out, the result of this experimentation was a silence. The story was not about what the genome told us. It was, and has been since, about what the genome didn't reveal. He then points out a newer set of buildings to the south, here, and thank you, Steve. So this one, and this one. These are rounded, placed within the landscape, planted with sedum roofs, fronted with cedar wood, which is weathered to a warm brownish cream. They are, he says, fuzzy, organic, complex structures. This is the location of research to add the biology back into this genetic sequence. It's here they're developing their work in functional genomics, searching for the function of each mapped gene using whole organisms. They do this by developing an array of different mouse models which have a genetic alteration. These can then be phenotyped, looking at the resulting bodily, sensory, cognitive and affective changes which provide clues to gene function, and the implication is new ways of understanding human disease. The building to the left, this one, is the new mouse house where the animals are kept, genetic alterations produced and bodily and other capacities measured. Two other structures accompany this facility. To the far right, which is this one, a purpose-built building has got a cafe, meeting rooms, lecture halls, a library, public engagement centre. This encourages communication between the sub-disciplines which now need to know how to work together. Adding biology back onto genomics is not only about producing animal models, it's also about integrating the practical expertise of molecular biology with mouse breeding, animal behaviour and clinical practice. And in the centre of those two is a building which more closely resembles those above. This is the new bioinformatics centre with a computational power to process and integrate this new information. Whereas the first set of buildings was about constructing biological data through the metaphor of computer code, this second set of buildings is designed to generate biological data through the practices of mutation, through the generation of monsters, perhaps. However, technical diagram is still crucial to the effort to integrate the potential of this biological excess. This is, after all, big science. Like the Human Genome Project, this endeavour is also an international one. The complexity of post-genomics means more facilities and more disciplines are involved than for the Human Genome Project. This slide is from 2006. And there are now more research sites producing and circulating genetically altered mice. There are several centres in the UK, many more in the USA, in Canada, Europe, Australia, and also East Asia. They're using different methods to produce these mutants and focus on different kinds of mutations and their relation to human disease. At this centre that I've just looked at, they're knocking out genes to see what happens. They are, I'm told, the largest producer of mouse knockouts on the planet. Many of these mutations currently exist only as mouse embryonic stem cells. Fewer have been fully characterised for their value as mouse models. There are plans to do so, but this remains a complex, challenging, and at times contested part of the science project. So this programme is monstrous in at least three senses of the word. It's monstrous in its scale. This scaling up from biology as code is not trivial. It involves the creation and articulation of new interdisciplinary spaces whose patterns are still evolving, even as I'm trying to trace them. It's secondly monstrous in its repositioning of the differentiated body at the centre of biology. Rather than searching for the normal, the ideal type, or the singular genetic code from which variations are defined, here mutation is of central interest and value. And thirdly, it's monstrous in the sense that it's orientated to the production of a variety of possibilities, not all of which will become facts. It's open to the future, to the monstrous arrivant in a way that the Human Genome Project wasn't, though, as I'll go on to suggest, it's not always able to welcome these monsters. So on to a second site. This is also in the UK, but this time I'm in the mouse house. Here, mutant mice are being produced using an alternative method. Whereas the knockout mouse have a known gene altered, ENU mutagenesis uses a powerful chemical mutagen to produce unknown mutations in the animal's offspring. These can then be phenotyped to trace bodily effects which may be useful in understanding or developing human disease models. I'm being shown their facilities by their head of phenotyping. Inside this building is what might be considered a conveyor belt for producing mutants. I stand in front of racks with cages stacked about 12 high and 6 along. The cages we stand in front of contain three animals, two females and one male. The males have been injected with ethyl nitrosurea, or ENU. ENU produces germline mutations. This is the start of the experiment. Numerous future generations have to be examined to work out the outcome. Dominant mutations may be picked up in the first litter of pups, but recessive mutations require further brother-sister matings and the examination of their offspring. Further generations may be needed to determine whether the mutation is inherited, and up to 20 brother-sister matings may be required to develop a stable strain, which can then be used as a scientific tool. So at this stage, as we stand there, the specific effects of this mutagen in these animals is unknown. The technique was used to develop large-scale screening of mutants in Drosophila flies. It's only very recently been adopted for use in mammals, and for many it's controversial. But to others, it's potentially the most exciting way of producing mutations and new understandings of human biology. Whereas other forms of genetic alteration start from what's already known to target specific genes, this generates surprises. It makes no assumption about the gene or the molecular pathway involved in producing bodily difference. It's potentially open to all possibilities, which might offer new models and understandings of human disease. The mathematical precision and prediction, the species code, apparently promised by the Human Genome Project, seems a long way away. This experiment is open to the future, the power of the unexpected in biology that is beyond our current understanding. And it's difficult to resist a comparison here between two approaches to understanding bodily difference personified by two men, both named Francis Bacon, divided by centuries and by scientific and artistic focus. The first, the philosopher, put mathematics at the centre of his quest for knowledge about bodily nature at the start of the Enlightenment. In The Advancement of Learning, published in 1605, Francis Bacon writes, "Scientists should imitate the wisdom of mathematicians, seeking repeatable universal meaning." The second is a 20th century British artist, Francis Bacon, who also deals with the relationship between figuration and structure and the challenge of returning to the body after the project of abstract painting. Deleuze writes in his account of Bacon's work that to do so involved a new approach. Bacon's constant formula, Deleuze says, was to create resemblance, but through accidental and non-resembling means. It's like the emergence of another world, for these marks, these traits, are irrational, involuntary, accidental, free, random. But they introduce possibilities of fact. The parallels with the return of the body to biology after the reductionism of the Human Genome Project are compelling and provocative. But of course, not all possibilities of fact cohere. Many fail. So what is a potentially interesting mutant? Which monsters introduce possibilities of fact? Here it is achieved through the creation of equivalence, resemblance, between human and animal bodies. In a form of domestication, the mutant animals are brought back into dialogue with human bodies through these experimental apparatus. Monsters do not have to look monstrous. Many of these animals lack any of the markers associated with classical notions of monstrosity. And actually, gross developmental abnormalities are rare. In fact, many of the animals, particularly those generated by ENU, are surprisingly normal. ENU produces often subtle point mutations on a single gene. The idea of the monster is, of course, closely related to what is normal. But here, it's the normal animals which are of little interest. The normal phenotype doesn't invite further inquiry. We can learn nothing new from them. In fact, the number of normal animals is a problem for this experimental system. The normality is excessive to its demands for surprise. The majority of the new phenotypes picked up here are sensory, affective, or cognitive ones. There are differences in learning, memory, anxiety, or social behaviours. These are potentially interesting to scientists as they reveal genes expressed in the brain and molecular pathways which are difficult to research in other ways. They're also interesting for their pharmaceutical value as we increasingly think of the realisation of our own potential in these molecular terms. These can be screened for in a battery of tests, which, as the book says, claim to tell you what's wrong with your mouse. Yet compared to the precision promised through genetics, these methods of phenotyping are surprisingly crude. On the slide there, there's a mouse that's been in a Morris water maze, one of the preferred methods for screening animals for memory and spatial learning. The test is about 30 years old, but its use is still increasing. It's popular for testing animal models for their relevance to research on Alzheimer's disease. And in this test, the mouse swims in the water. It's a large kind of drum of water about that big. The mouse swims in this water until it locates an underwater platform on which it can rest, which is what the mouse is doing here. In repeated experiments, visual clues lead back to this platform, the time taken to return, measuring learning and memory in the mouse. The advantage of these simple tests is their simplicity and their replicability. Data can easily be generated from the new genetically altered animals and articulate with existing data sets. The strange can become sensible. But something is lost in this articulation of the animal body to the demands of technology. It risks reinserting simplistic notions of causation into the experimental systems of functional genomics. The complex relationships between bodily capacities and external environment are hidden in the assumptions embedded in the apparatus. In another interview, this time in an academic setting in the US, one woman discusses her profound questions about the value of the Morris maze in testing genetically altered mice. She runs a phenotyping program which characterizes mice for other researchers. She works here, but we chat in a nearby coffee shop. She's frequently asked to use the Morris maze to test mice, yet she has a different disciplinary history from the molecular biologists who commission these tests, one of behavioral science and neuroscience. To her, this test may be meaningless. It may articulate research results with past data, but it's insensitive to these specific animal bodies, she argues. The Morris maze test was originally designed for rats who love to swim. Mice, on the other hand, avoid water. She suggests the test may more accurately represent anxiety-related behaviours in this species. The favoured laboratory strain of mice on which genetic alterations are done, the C57 Black 6, loses eyesight early due to its inbred nature. The mice cannot see the markers. Maybe, in fact, it's a test for residual sight. Or there could be issues in gait which alter the animal's ability to swim. Perhaps it's a test for motor skills. Mice can communicate with ultrasonic vocalizations. This is a new discovery with implications still to be worked out for behavioral testing. But perhaps we're testing communication between animals. It might be all these things together. She's nearing retirement, and personally she feels her energies to fight these battles is limited. She prompts those requesting this test, but still carries them out on a regular basis. This then is another sense in which this research has monstrous potential. It opens up breaches in the technical and disciplinary practices of biology. The bodily specificities of these animals need to be taken seriously in all kinds of ways, she suggests, to answer pertinent and growing questions about the ability of this research to speak to the demands of translational medicine. The capacities of mice, their experiences, their environments and their relations have to be understood in more species-relevant ways to make this research valuable to understanding human embodiment. This is the contemporary imperative, translational medicine, to move research to clinical and hospital settings. Hospital and hospitality, of course, share an etymology deriving from the Latin to shelter or care for bodily need. It suggests a new kind of transaction between bodies than the equivalence that was drawn in the codes of genomics. The need to be of value in developing care for the human body opens up questions about how we care for these strange animal beings. To adapt Derrida again, this biology has to learn how to welcome the monstrous arrivant. To welcome it, that is, to accord hospitality to that which is absolutely foreign or strange. There is a current lack of expertise in animal behaviour and a lack of funding for veterinary medicine that hinders this hospitality. And as the number of mutant mice waiting to be phenotyped continues to increase, these issues become increasingly centrally important. And so there are ethical issues too in this use of animals. There was an expectation that genomics would usher in an era of in silico experimentation with animal models replaced by sophisticated computer systems. In fact, the silence of the genome has resulted in an explosion of corporeal experimentation and a cacophony of alternative approaches, a production of biological surplus, perhaps. The mouse houses are literally becoming full. This excess disturbs many people, both within and outside of the community. The ethical questions circulate widely, but often overspill the conventional framing of debates around animal experimentation. I first encounter them at a conference in Utrecht, entitled Looking into the Crystal Ball, the Laboratory Animal in a Changing World. The meeting is held in a beautiful medieval building in central Utrecht. I'm in a session on genetic models. There are welfare scientists, molecular biologists, welfare groups, and pharmaceutical companies present. The ethics of ENU mutagenesis becomes a focus of our discussion. The challenges of domesticating this technology are evident. For some genetic researchers, it's an epistemic threat. This is just not science. It leaves aside hypothesis-driven research for open-ended experimentation with future forms. What does this do to the status of other previous research in genetics? Is this the best use of increasingly scarce resources in science? They don't welcome this challenge to their authority. For those regulating animal research, securing the social contract on which animal experimentation in Europe is based, it's also potentially excessive. The number of mice used goes against the grain of European commitments to reduce and replace animals in research. For the majority of mice, the procedures are non-invasive, breeding and behavioural testing. And people, when I sort of question them about ENU mutagenesis, they say, well, actually, it's just a lot of mouse sex. But for some, mutations may be both deleterious to the animal, but also useful to understanding human disease. There's also the chance of producing the same mutants again and again, so producing mutants which have no value. The challenge is there's no way of knowing in advance whether you're going to produce an animal that has no mutation, that has a useful mutation, or a mutation that you already have. The UK Home Office evaluates the ethics of animal experimentation by weighing costs and benefits. This much cost to this many animals, balanced against these potential benefits to this area of human health. This calculation can't be done for such open-ended techniques as mutagenesis. This monstrous arrivant overspills the law in this case. At one point in this debate, someone calls for people to put their hands up if they think ENU mutagenesis is unethical. A few hands go up, but almost everyone hesitates. This moment of shared hesitancy is an ethical moment, I would argue. Haraway is perhaps useful here. In her book When Species Meet, she suggests to quote, "I refuse the choice of inviolable animal rights versus human good is more important." Both of these proceed as if calculation solved the dilemma, and all I or we have to do is choose. I also refuse to choose in this meeting. I don't put up my hand. I don't know what to do. I'm not ready personally to close down these ambiguities, but I also don't want to foreclose the kinds of conversations and the kinds of people I might want to talk to in this project. I felt, again, drawing on Haraway, there might be value in staying with the trouble. So I prose this pause in discussion with individuals later on in the research. There are some who assert the unproblematic value of ENU mutagenesis. It's a good way to develop mutants which are of potential value to modelling disease. The ethical imperative here is that we need to do something to alleviate human suffering. It becomes a technological imperative. We can do this, so we should do it. All means are valid. There are also those who assert this is unethical. All animal experimentation should stop. Their position is also defined a priori. They're not interested in refinements or reductions, only in replacement. Both of these are well-established positions, well-known to each other, shaping the space in which debate takes place. But they're arguably no longer where the work of ethics, the uncertainty, the reaching towards something new, is being done. The inability to choose, the pause, I would argue, is the start of unexpected kinds of questioning. At the moment, these are proceeding through personal narrative and anecdote as people's positions shift. In another context, I talked to someone from a laboratory animal supplier. She knows people who've moved out of the industry as they just felt they couldn't kill another mouse. This is not the individual animal suffering, though, which traditionally mobilises animal rights, but the personal toll taken by having to cull large numbers of healthy animals. I talked to others broadly working within the animal protection community. They're now working with funders and scientists to increase access to resources, to share already generated mouse models, to coordinate phenotype data, and reduce some of these redundancies. Working so closely with the laboratory animal science community, the person running this initiative, although placed within an animal welfare group, has taken their details off the web for fear of being targeted by animal extremists. The ethical prompting of post-genomics is thus emerging how to manage this excess, whether experimental, corporeal, or effective. Post-genomics exceeds the calculative strategies of genomics, ushering in a gap between the biological surplus of life and the biological practices of diagramming. As Sarah Franklin notes, biology has always meant the thing itself and knowledge of what it is. These are not the same, but they are related. This questioning of the practice in post-genomics is beginning to change our understanding of the animal, but also of our own biology. Following Haraway, I would argue these animals do have promise. These monsters have a promise. A promise to put diversity, difference, an alterity at the centre of biology. There's a return to biology and a consideration of embodiment following the reductionist lens of genetics over the last 20 years. In 1999, the anthropologist Paul Rabinow writes, "If ever there was an example of brute life, the minimalist essence of things, it is genomics." I'd argue this period of genetic reductionism and determinism reached its limit. No one could say this now. The production of bodily diversity in mice is now being used as the standpoint from which to say something about what it means to be embodied, to have a body. And we find companies like this. It's actually a company based in the Netherlands, but it's offering us a direct link between phenotyping mouse diversity and the assertion in that little inset there, that each one of us is strikingly different. At the same time as genetics is decentered, so other kinds of expertise and other kinds of bodily care are emerging as important. These mutant animals may also have the potential to question what it means to care for a body, to be hospitable to bodily difference. In this, I'd argue, there are new potentialities, new associations, new, more diverse models of what it means to be an embodied human or non-human animal. And as I've gone on in this project, I've seen this kind of questioning about what a model is, about questions of husbandry, emerging increasingly readily and with increasing humility at conferences. There are cautions too, of course. Whilst I've enjoyed encounters with articulate individuals, it's currently the technical devices which allow these animal bodies to speak to past research, international efforts and future treatments. Such configurations may be inhospitable to difference and limit the kinds of things that we allow these bodies to say. This is also evident in this slide here, in the ultimate focus on drug intervention, the technical fix, as it were. Yet locating the monstrous at the centre of the contemporary practices of biology does offer a route to tracing these issues as they're debated by scientists themselves. And their questioning of their work, particularly by a few key individuals, frequently exceeds the way that I can question them. In this sense, too, there is potential This effort of post-genomics is monstrous in its challenge to the organisation of biology itself. And what's interesting to me as a geographer is the way that this draws our attention back to questions of space, to the complex spatial qualities of post-genomics. These emerging topologies are different to the mapping strategies of genetics as the mouse moves in from the borderland. And this is the last point and the last site that I want to explore and use really somebody else's reflections by way of my own kinds of conclusions. I'll introduce these issues through conversations with one individual. He's somebody I encountered at international conferences in Washington and San Diego, but he works here at a Center for Experimental Genetics in Europe. Now, I've yet to visit this facility. I'm going in the summer, but it seems fitting to locate his arguments. The project is, of course, larger than this one individual, and many of our discussions revolve around their work on what he calls an integrated mouse clinic. The aim of the mouse clinic is to combine the work of generating mutants, the expertise to phenotype them, the facilities to archive them, and the ability to distribute them, and so gain a new understanding of relations. As we talk through the aims of the project, it's clear that on many levels, space matters intimately to the project of what he's trying to achieve. Perhaps this shouldn't be surprising. Apart from excess, space has always been the other central theme in the fables we tell about mice, their morality and their mobility. Just think about Aesop's story of the encounter between the town mouse and the country mouse. Space appears here in at least three ways, I would argue. First is the apparently simple question of spatially coordinating experiments which are widely distributed. This site is envisaged as a centre for mouse research, a leader in its field, but this is an open configuration with links across Europe and to the rest of the world. The building has been designed from the outset to be hospitable to collaboration with other institutes. They have guest laboratories, for example. Like many new animal facilities, it's designed to be specified pathogen-free, but these are not sealed facilities that would prevent other animals from other institutions entering for phenotyping. He suggests that whilst other research centres are now becoming more open to the community, their design is not, their barrier facilities which prevent animals moving in or out. So he's designed this with an open space, if you like, in mind. He's also prepared to move slowly when necessary. For him, this research is part of a European project. He welcomes partners who are less state-of-the-art. There's a chance that in 5 years' time they might be, but he also believes in the value of working together on a larger project that's also a European one. He says there's a richness in these collaborations. It may be slower than some of the other single centres, but the focus is broader, more expansive, more suited to the questioning of post-genomics, more likely to bring future productive collaborations. He's also increasingly interested in the space occupied by the animals themselves. The aim of the mouse clinic is to bring together facilities that can be hospitable to the monster arriving in the centre of genomics. Bringing the different tasks of generating, creating and distributing mutants into one facility, the mouse clinic has the potential to reduce confounding factors that result from moving animals around the place, moving from one laboratory to testing and so on, which introduce differences in heat, light, noise, bedding, water, personnel and so on, which all affect the way an animal might react to a test. However, he's not seeking just a simple standardisation. More than this, he's working to characterise environment or space itself as a key variable in post-genomics. And this is the box here, which he calls the envirotype. The envirotype takes its place alongside the genotype and the phenotype. The first five envirotypes being characterised and tested are those considered most relevant to human health. He explains it as follows. I thought about what are the 5 major impacts on human health. So I was sitting together, not only me, it's a group of people here thinking about these things. It was clear, it's exercise, nutrition, it's air, it's infection and stress. So these are the major impacts we have every day. Let's try and find this out. And we're currently working on what we call envirotypes. It's very difficult, but that's what we're working on. And you'll find in there, there's something about relating mouse and human envirotypes. So thinking not only about the space occupied by the mice, but also how that might relate to spaces in which people are working. Trying to understand the interaction between these newly characterized variables then begins to challenge what I've called there the spaces of relation. By this I mean the kinds of language, diagrams, topological imaginations that we use to try and understand relations. There are relations here between gene and gene, between gene and phenotype, gene and envirotype, and of course all the interrelations that are layered on top of that. So this is a long way from where we started, with the Euclidean geometries of the Human Genome Project, its emphasis on location, its assumptions of mapping as the prelude to reading off bodily traits. As you probably noticed from the images in this presentation, coordinates actually tell you very little. Postgenomics is a search for a new grammar of biology, a new way of thinking about relations, which are also relations in space. And there's a reaching towards something new in this practice. The monstrous arrivant unsettles our conceptual and our perceptual categories. And I would argue it also opens up a role for social scientists in intervening or thinking about these dialogues, in holding on to the different kinds of conditions of possibility, if you like, that they entail. This conversation, though, has to stop, as fittingly for this project, the person I'm talking to has to catch a plane. But we also reach the limits of language. Yet again, the mice seem to have eaten our words, forcing us to suspend judgment. So I'll leave the last hesitant words to him. We struggle with having 3 or 4 genes, and then we make up drawings in PowerPoint at the moment. This will not be the way to tackle it in the next decade. Some people have thought about why not do it as, not with words, but maybe with tones. How can we receive this information? How can we take it in? How can we hear it or visualize it? Of course, I don't know. They're just weird ideas. But we have to work on that for the future.